Seated. Well, we're in our series, Live Loud, and we've been looking at how God has called us to live our faith in bold and impactful ways. And since it's Father's Day, we want to take the theme and apply it to moms and dads, to parents. There are applications for grandparents, and if you're single and you don't have kids, there are applications for how you can live your life in such a way as to impact a child or someone else of the next generation. But we want to talk today about how fathers, parents, can live their faith in such a way that it's a powerful shaping force for good in the lives of their kids in a difficult world. And we need to talk about these things because parenting is tough. Raising a child today is very difficult. I remember bringing our kid home, Stephen, home for the first time, our first child, and we're thinking, like, what do we do? Like, is there a manual? We went through all this stuff that they sent us from the hospital. There was no manual. It's like, what do you do? Like, shouldn't there be, like, something? If they're crying, do this. If they're pooping, do this. If, you know, is there something, they're not sleeping at night, do this. I mean, that would be fantastic. And there was no such manual. And then just as you're getting the hand, you know, getting the hang of the infancy, and then they're toddlers, and you're baby-proofing your house, and then they're in grammar school, there's all these phases. And you have to adjust your strategies, because strategies that once worked no longer work at the next stage. So you're always making adjustments. You're always changing things up. And of course, as parents, we're imperfect. You know, along the way, we make mistakes. I've made mistakes. Every parent makes mistakes. There are times when we don't read situations just right. Now, I think, you know, my kid is saying something to me, and I'm reading it, and Denise is like, I don't think you're seeing it. What they're saying. I'm like, I totally get what they're saying. And she's like, I don't know. I mean, we read things wrong. We react sometimes in the wrong way. We can, you know, react in a way where we're angry or we're frustrated or things that maybe aren't really warranted in that moment. And of course, there are regrets that we have all said things or done things that we would do differently. And so there's a lot of complexity to the parenting role, and we need guidance. And that's the great thing about Scripture, is that the Bible lays out for us, and Jesus lays out for us a pathway forward to raise our kids in such a way that we can live our faith out loud as parents, and we can help our kids do exactly the same. And I want to start where we were last week, when we looked at the Beatitudes, where Jesus talked about distinctive qualities that Christ followers embody. That when you think of a Christian, a person who follows Jesus, it's not about like they're religious or they go to church or they're not at home on Sunday mornings, you know, that they speak religious lingo or they carry Bibles around or those kinds of things. But something else is a distinctive of faith. It's about lifestyle, as described in the Beatitudes, that there are certain qualities that we live out and certain characteristics that we embody. Jesus describes these in Matthew 5, 1 through 10, and I want to look at them again this morning. It says, now when he saw the crowds, Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on the mountainside and sat down, and his disciples came to him, and he began to teach them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. And blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Each of these qualities that Jesus lays out here at the beginning of the most well-known sermon Jesus ever preached, and the most well-known sermon that was ever preached, the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5 through 7. Jesus kicks off that teaching with these Beatitudes, the attitudes that you and I are to embrace, the distinctive qualities of someone who follows after him. And he lays out these qualities, and they're kind of shocking. because they're so countercultural. What Jesus embraces and values is often starkly different than what the world around us tells us we should embrace and value. And so Jesus talks about being poor in spirit, something no one says we should embrace around us, but Jesus says we should. Poor in spirit speaks of understanding our brokenness and our need for grace, our need for God. You know, blessed are those who mourn. It's not about being depressed and moping around like, oh, woe is me. I mean, that's not what Jesus is saying, but there's a sense here where we have sincere sorrow for the missteps that in our lives and for our mistakes, for our failings and our sin. Blessed are the meek, and we looked last week at these in more depth. It's not weakness. Meekness is not weakness. It's actually strength. It's strength under control. It's the ability to hurt somebody, to seek retribution, to damage somebody. But my unwillingness, because of my values, because of my commitment to Christ, because I march to the beat of a different drummer than my own emotions and my own inclinations, I have power and self-discipline and patience not to step out and hurt somebody in those ways. Meekness, much more hungering and thirsting for righteousness, mercy, being pure in heart, being a peacemaker, and even expecting that when we live these countercultural qualities, that there are going to be times when we are persecuted, when we are treated harshly because we're a follower of Jesus. Not because we've done something wrong, not because we've hurt somebody or we've stepped over a boundary of some way, but simply because we're faithful to him. Because we are embodying and living out these qualities, there are going to be people around us who gravitate towards other values, who say, this is a challenge to my value system. I don't like that. So we'll be persecuted. We'll have to take on flack from time to time. But what's interesting about all this is that the ultimate outcome of these distinctives, the ultimate outcome of a lifestyle that honors Jesus, is very clear in this passage. The first thing we see is that this countercultural lifestyle that the world rejects, that the world scoffs at, is actually the pathway to happiness. And we saw how the word blessed, makarios in the Greek, means happy is. In other words, true joy and happiness is not found by listening to what the world says, by pursuing what our self-inclined heart wants. We think this is the path to happiness. We think this path is going to lead us. We've got plenty of people around us that will cheer us on as we go the way of the world and pursue its values. And God says, you're going to be empty. You're going to be empty. It's going to be a momentary thing. It's going to be a fleeting moment, maybe a thrill for just a second, but then it's gone. And so true happiness comes when we root ourselves in the lifestyle that Jesus has for us. True happiness is not found in what the world says will make you happy, but in what Jesus tells us about lifestyle and how when we align our lives with him, things get better. We truly find the happiness we're longing for. We also saw that the second outcome here is what peacemaking is about, because the word peacemaker, it seems to work towards this climax in these Beatitudes, and peace is a key theme. It's the word shalom, the Hebrew word for well-being. We're looking for peace, not simply a cessation of battles. It's not the absence of something, but the presence of well-being in our lives. And we want that. We want a sense of well-being. We want a good outcome for our future. It speaks of everything that leads us to a higher good, long-term benefit, long-term good in our own lives. So all of this is rooted in a lifestyle, a countercultural lifestyle. It's a curveball from God, and yet happiness and peace are found there. This doesn't mean that we don't have troubles. Jesus isn't saying that we won't have moments where we struggle. He right here lays out, it says you're going to be persecuted. There's going to be people around you who don't want to be around you simply because you're a follower of Jesus. You won't always be with the cool crowd. Not everybody's going to think you're great. You know, if that's your goal, to fit in with everybody and be popular with everybody, you can't really effectively follow the Lord because there's going to be people that aren't buying into that. They're not interested in that. So Jesus isn't saying that life is going to be perfect, that, you know, everything will be easy and go well for you in that way. We will get flack. There will be challenges. There will be hardship. We will experience suffering. Every person in this world, it's part and parcel of this world, that sin and brokenness is rampant, that the rain falls on the righteous and the unrighteous. So we're part of this world. And yet somehow in the midst of the flack, persecution, and hardship, in the midst of that, somehow we have peace. Somehow, in the midst of maybe our toughest time, when we're faithful to Him and following Him, despite the tension and challenge, we have joy. That can't be found anywhere else. Blessedness only comes from following Him. And when we overcome these struggles by persevering, over time, life gets better. Over time, as you follow Him and embrace these values, there's less and less drama in your life. Would anybody here sign up for a little less drama in their life? I think there's a lot of people around us. I was like, you know, I'd like to sign up. How do I sign up for less drama? This is how you do that. This is how you work in that direction. You know, it's interesting that the message of the Old Testament is exactly the same as Jesus lays out here. And I want to look today at a point in time where Moses spoke to the Hebrew people about this same message, about how God works for good in our lives when we put Him first. And he lays this out in Deuteronomy 6, 1 through 4. Let's look at that. It says, "These are the commands, decrees, and laws the Lord your God directed me to teach you to observe in the land you are crossing the Jordan to possess, so that you, your children, and their children after them may fear the Lord your God as long as you live, by keeping all His decrees and commands that I give you, and so that you may enjoy long life. Hear, O Israel, and be careful to obey, so that it may go well with you, so that you may increase greatly in a land flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, promised you." Moses is writing these words at a critical juncture in the life of the nation. The nation has been in bondage in Egypt for hundreds of years. It has wandered for 40 years in the wilderness. It's looking for its home. The nation is forming, and God is bringing them into the promised land, the land of Canaan, a land flowing with milk and honey. And as he prepares this nation to grow and become strong, it's very interesting. Moses wants to give principles so that the nation is healthy, so that the nation is able to navigate the challenges of this new land, of a new environment, of lots of temptations. And it's fascinating that when Moses addresses the people of Israel about a healthy future and a sound nation, I think it's fascinating that he addresses the building block of a great nation. He addresses a family. He addresses dad. He addresses mom. Because when dad and mom get it right, a lot of things start going well in community and nationally and around them. And this is what he says to them. He says, "I want to prepare you so that you can maintain your faith in a new environment. I want you to understand principles so that you can develop a healthy family life that ultimately leads to good things, to a positive outcome, to the life that you're really longing for." He goes on to talk about this path to blessing and prosperity. Verse 4, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. And I want us to see, first of all, the flow of this passage. Because Moses is saying, listen, a prosperous future is yours. A blessed future is available to you. An outcome where you look back on your life with less regret, less drama, and more joy and peace is available to you. It's within your grasp. But there's certain things that you need to follow. There's a certain pathway to that peace that I want to lay out for you. The flow of the passage really begins with this call to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind and strength. And that's for every person. That's for whether you're single or young or your child or an adult, a grandparent, moms and dads. That's the primary laser-like focus here, but it's for everybody. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind and strength. And it means that every single person's potential and best interest, your best interest for your best future is wrapped up in this one act to love God. That the best version of yourself is unlocked and released when you align yourself with this one command to love God, that we're wired and created to live in sync with God. We're wired and created to live in sync with His plan and His purpose. We were created for that reason. And something will always be missing in your life and in my life. Something will always be missing when we're out of sync with Him. When we're partway or part-time or on the fence with Him, and I've been there, something will always be missing when we're not aligning our lives as fully as possible with Him. And so here, verse 5, he says, Mom and Dad, love God. Treasure Him. Use your time to honor Him. Use your treasure to honor Him. Use your talents. Make that very obvious to your children that your first priority is Him. Love Him. Then it goes on to verse 7 to say, and teach them. So live it, embody it, embrace it, grow in it. When you screw it up, and you will, get back on track. Dust yourself off, let God pull you back up, get back on track, and move forward. And then begin to impress it on your children. Teach them the reasons for your faith, the nature and goodness of God. Help them to see the power of His word and His faithfulness. And when we live it, when we teach it, there's a payoff. There's a payoff to that type of life. Modeling this Christ-honoring lifestyle reaps huge benefits. Verse 2 says, so that you may enjoy a long life. Verse 3 says, so it may go well with you. Verse 3, so you may greatly increase in a land flowing with milk and honey. You know, in the Old Testament, it's fascinating. Because there's a definite connection between the life we live and the lifestyle we choose and the quality of life we enjoy now and even the length of life we enjoy, how long we live. Now, we know this is a general principle because I think every one of us can say, I know somebody who loves God, really loved God, and they died young. Or I know somebody who really hated God and was kind of vile and angry and mean, and no one liked them, and they never would die. They just kept living and living. It's like, man, shouldn't you just be disappearing? They're like, they just refuse to die. I mean, I played golf one time, and that guy had to be 80 or 90 years old, shuffling across a golf green and a par 3, and I could hear him long, far away, smoking cigarettes, cursing up a storm, cursing. I'm like, oh my gosh. He was playing alone. I mean, kind of interesting that he was playing alone. But I was like, man, some people are so angry, and they just don't die. They don't die. But there's a general principle here, a general principle that a Christ-honoring lifestyle brings long-term positive results, that we will greatly increase. It's the same message of the Beatitudes of blessedness and joy and happiness and peace. So I think all this leads us to as parents, an important component in all this, that we need, in terms of our faith, to live it, to speak it, and then to patiently wait for blessing. Just because you're faithful for a month or faithful for a week or a year doesn't mean that the blessing is right there. You know, some people think, well, like when you teach tithing or those kinds of things, the Lord says if you bring your, you know, tithe to the storehouse, he'll open up the floodgates of heaven. So they tithe, and then next week they go to the mailbox and say, okay, God, I'm waiting for the check. You're going to pay me back. But you know what? That's not how it works. There's a long-term sense of blessing. Your blessing is coming, but let me just stress, patiently wait. Patiently wait. Because blessing absolutely, positively is coming. So the question is, what are some ways that we as parents can do this? I think first we need to help our children see that the ultimate path to success always involves strong faith. The ultimate path to success always involves strong faith. Matthew 16, 24 through 26 says, then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will find it. What good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world and yet he forfeits his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? Jesus says, if you want to be a follower, there are certain things that you need to think about. There are certain ways you need to live. There are certain attitudes you need to embrace. It's not just a matter of saying, I'm a Christian, or I'm a follower of God, I go to church. That's not important. Words are not important to him. Or, you know, the fact that we go to a building, that's not something that is at the top of his list. Loving him, though, and following him involves certain pieces. It means, first of all, if you want to come after him, we must deny ourselves. And that means stepping away from our declared independence from him and like, God, I can do this on my own. Stepping away from our self-sufficiency and embracing God's sufficiency, that he's sufficient to meet my needs. I don't have to do it all. I don't have to, you know, I'm not the center of the universe anymore. I'm stepping off the throne of the universe. I'm not the CEO of all things anymore. God, you are. So this sense that we don't replace God anymore with our own wants or desires. We want his will foremost, most of all. And then it says we're to take up his cross. The cross in the first century, the crosses were everywhere in the first century. They dotted the horizon, the landscape, and it was Rome's way of saying we're in control and we're all powerful. And as we know, when Jesus was crucified, he had to carry the cross beam of that cross through the streets, and it was a symbol of his submission to Rome. It was a public statement that Rome is in control, and Jesus is saying here that we're to take up our cross. Not literally, but we're to take up our cross by saying, I identify publicly with the person of Jesus Christ. Just as someone carrying that cross is identifying, you know, in a public way, their submission to Rome. Now, we carry our cross and we identify publicly our submission to Jesus. That we're not embarrassed about this. We're not afraid about this. We're not ashamed of this anymore. That we're like, you know what? I'm not going to preach in your face. I'm not going to throw Bible verses at you. I'm not going to be all over you. But I'm not ashamed to be a follower of Jesus. I publicly identify with him. We take up our cross and then we follow him. That's the pathway to what God desires of us. And then he gives us two reasons. He substantiates this and says we're to live this way, first of all, because whoever wants to save his life is going to lose it. If you live just for yourself, just for your needs and just for this life, you're going to lose. You're going to lose because this life is so short. If it's all about you all the time, you're going to lose badly because there's a future in store for us. And we build up treasure in heaven and we prepare ourselves for eternity by giving, not by getting, by serving other people. So we're to live this way because, you know, we try to live for this life only, we lose. But then he says, what good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? I mean, live this way, secondly, because even if you are famous, Kim Kardashian famous, Instagram hero, even if you got all kinds of things going on for you, power and money and fame, and you neglect your soul, you lose. Even if every dream you've ever had about this world came true for you, and you neglect your spiritual self, you're spiritually impoverished, in the end, you lose. Jesus is in effect saying to parents, what good is it if your children climb to the top of the ladder in their profession, you know, if they make it big, if they pass the bar exam, if they become an Olympic athlete? What good is if they get the scholarship to Yale and they're the salesperson of the year over and over again? If they have a yacht and money and all kinds of things, if they have power and prestige, what good is it if we're Parade Magazine's Parent of the Year, we get the award and all the accolades? What good is it if we gain the whole world, the world just fawning at our feet and just loves us and embraces us, and we forfeit our soul? What good is it? It's no good. What good is it to have cared for every need your children have and then neglect their spiritual development and eternal destiny? What good is it? We're missing out. Eternity will be much, much longer than this life. And the best thing we can do is prepare them for that eternity, to live it and to teach it, to wait patiently for blessing. True success is so different. It's gaining God. It's knowing him better. It's following his call, giving our best to him, serving others, representing him well. So parents, first, we need to model the lifestyle qualities and values Jesus teaches and help them see the positive outcome of a Jesus-centered life. But there's one more thing. We need to equip our kids to handle a world that sometimes does not value a Jesus-focused life. You see, there's three ways that parents often try to prepare their kids for adulthood. Three different styles of parenting. The first is what we could call the hands-off approach. This is where parents basically say, you know, I'm laissez-faire, hands-off. I just want you to do and be whatever you want to be. And so it's almost like you look at parenting as a buffet. Life is full, it's a buffet of all kinds of things. And your goal, your only goal is to give them a plate. You give them a plate and they can go grab roast beef and turkey, marshmallows, gummy bears, bread, whatever, you know, pumpkin pie. They just go, and your goal is to simply let them make whatever choices they want. Anchovies, beets, whatever. Ugh, those are the worst. But if they want them, go for it. Denise is trying to convince me to eat beet salad. I'm not eating beets. But anyway, the idea here is the child should be free to choose whatever values or commitments or activities they want. And the parent is thinking this: what right do I have to impose my beliefs on my kids. I mean, if the child wants to hang out with certain people, let them do it. If they want to have lewd stuff, posters on their wall, I mean, I don't like it, but I guess we're just going to do it. Whatever violent or sexual stuff they're watching, we'll let them do it. If they want to join a California cult that worships pink mushrooms, I mean, go ahead. I mean, whatever. It's not that they don't care. They just want their child to make their own choices. And they're very, very concerned about imposing. But the passive parent misses the point. They miss the point because while they're sitting out and sitting back, doing little to direct their child, the world is pumping them with all kinds of brokenness, all kinds of destructive belief systems and lifestyles. What the passive parent doesn't understand is that they've turned their child over to a toxic culture. And I've seen this over the years. We think, well, these parents don't exist. Oh, they exist. I've seen them many, many times over the years. And the outcome is never good. And when it comes to spiritual things, there's a catastrophic outcome to a passive parent because it presents Jesus as an option. Jesus is one option among many. And so you may choose Jesus, you may not. It's your opinion. Yet Jesus is this or that, and I'll give you my opinion, but Jesus didn't present himself as Lord and Savior over the world as an opinion. He presented himself as an absolute truth. There is absolute truth in this world. Do we know that? Gravity, you know, makes that pretty clear. That's a pretty clear absolute truth. If you fall down into the parking lot, down is where you go. You go down. You don't go up. Gravity is an absolute truth. Jesus says he's an absolute truth, not an opinion or an option. He said, I am the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. So he doesn't give us an option. And yet the passive parent makes a catastrophic mistake by presenting him as an option. The truth is that kids need guardrails to keep them off from plunging over cliffs. And they need guidelines to lead them to faith because sometimes the world can really deceive us. That doesn't get us to the right type of parenting. And there's another type, the overprotect and withdraw approach. The idea here is that in order to remain faithful to God, we need to establish rules and regulations, a rigorous system with thick walls to protect our kids from the world and keep it at bay. Here, culture is evil and should be rejected. And so here we see parents who dictate to their kids biblical values in such a way that every influence in their life is Christian. They must attend Christian school. They must watch Christian programming only. You have Christian friends, Christian books, Christian literature. Everything in their lives is edited to protect them. It becomes a kind of withdrawing and cocooning. And yet, now as we look at the parenting task, we'd say, to some degree, that's essential. Every good parent wants to protect their kids from an often dangerous and deceitful world, no doubt. But all culture is not evil. Not everything around us is to be rejected because it's something found in society. Jesus never looked at the world of people and culture and said it was evil to be rejected. Jesus never said that we shouldn't be around people who have different viewpoints or lifestyles. And so ultimately, we can't obey God and cocoon. We can't obey God and bring faith to other people if we withdraw from the very people God wants us to reach. We can't obey God if we're constantly afraid of contamination. We can't obey God if we cannot dialogue intelligently with people who disagree with us. We have to have ability to have a conversation and know that there's people out there who don't agree with us. Jesus demonstrated the importance of stepping away from a cocoon. He went to parties. He even brought the wine once. He heard all kinds of crazy stories. There was language at these parties that was pretty questionable and over the top. Imagine Matthew's friends telling some stories. They weren't really very cool. And Jesus didn't condone everything that happened at the parties because he was there. But he went with a mission. His mission was to bring light to build a relationship, to connect with other people and bring them to faith. And cocooning and withdrawing doesn't get it done. But there's one more pathway that helps us put Deuteronomy 6 into practice. It's the equipping approach. The idea here is that as parents, we protect our kids from the worst of society and the worst of culture. Absolutely. We have a role and a responsibility to protect our kids. But we also go much further. We equip our kids to handle the world, to have dialogue with those who disagree, and to deal with situations that are part and parcel of this world. So look for teachable moments. Watch the news and talk about it. Watch politics and take a balanced approach so that your kids can see that not everybody is evil, that we've got to have a better, higher standard for how we interact and dialogue. Have discussions about media and sexuality. You know, why is sleeping with my girlfriend, experimenting with drugs, hanging out with the crazy crowd a bad idea? Why should we believe in God when others don't? Like, why? You know, step up to the challenge. How do we live our faith in a multicultural society? How do we defend our faith? How do we handle those who don't embrace Jesus' values? How do we deal with setbacks when life doesn't go well, when we don't have a date for the prom, when we can't afford a car and we can't get anywhere, when we've been cut from the team, when our report card isn't so great? How do we handle setbacks? Well, that's an opportunity for us to step up and say, I want to equip you to handle the ups and downs, the joys and the sorrows and challenges of this life. God's called us as parents to be equippers. And so today, as we come to this whole concept of living loud, to live loud as a mom, as a dad, as a grandparent even as a friend. God calls us to live in such a way that we're not withdrawing, we're not just giving into the world, we're not cocooning, but we're equipping. We're helping our kids deal with this world and to be a impactful force for good. Because the truth is, mom and dad, the best gift you can give your kid is not a new car. It's not 4 years of a college education. It's not a brand new tuba or violin, expensive new cello. The best gift you can give your kid by far is a solid foundation in faith that will sustain them through every wind they will ever encounter, that will bring them to that point of joy and peace, and that ends in a life of makarios, true happiness, a true sense of God's goodness, that they'll know when we live loud, our life does get better. The outcome will be good. Let's pray.